The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, we're just about there. The Super Cup raised the curtain on the 2021 season on Saturday. And we have five teams left to preview to get our listeners ready for the start of the season proper.
Yeah, I'm very excited. The Super Cup definitely whetted the appetite. I always go into a season half excited, half just dreading the 3 a.m. wake-up calls. But yeah, that was a terrific game. I was that excited. This time yesterday, I'd already set up and I was waiting for you two to call. And I think I got the day slightly mixed up. But yeah, I was excited and ready to go.
All right, well, that's my fault, Sam. I didn't confirm a Tuesday recording this week. Very, very sorry about that. But listeners, yeah, that gives you an idea of the commitment Sam has to J-Talk. And if it was ever in doubt, well, then that's well and truly put to bed, no question. Without any further ado, let's welcome in our guest who is here to help us preview Nagoya, both Osaka clubs, Gunma Osaka and Cerezo, Kobe and Hiroshima. Johnny Nicol, it's great to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, Ben, and my first time on in 2021. I'm looking forward to it. We've got five good teams to look at this week, and I've found some nice things to say about each of them, even Cerezo.
Well, that must have stretched you to the absolute limit, Johnny, but look forward to hearing that. Before we dive in with our look back at the Super Cup, a big thanks to Andrew Schmidt, Ralph, a.k.a. Akakichino 11, Gabriel Anello, Jamie Makel, Kevin and Ryan Cook for your questions on this episode. Ryan is our newest supporter on Patreon, and he dove straight in with a couple of questions. We absolutely love to see that. So welcome aboard, Ryan. Thanks to our other patrons for their questions. And indeed, Ryan joins a very illustrious list of patrons who have come on board since the end of the last J1 season. Kame Cave, Ricardo, Jonathan, Rob, David, and indeed Ryan himself have all joined the good ship J-Talk. So to all of them, thank you very much for coming on board in the past couple of months, just in time for the start of the new season. That, saw the curtain raised on Saturday at Saitama Stadium, just over 4,000 in attendance. And, people who maybe had something to do at halftime won't have been surprised to find out that Kawasaki won this game, because they roared into a 2-0 lead in the first half and were cruising. But Gunma certainly came out swinging in the second half.
Yeah, definitely as a neutral and as a Gamba supporter, you were quite disappointed with that first half, because Kawasaki were completely dominant. They pressed Gamba really high. They caused a lot of errors at the back, kind of took advantage of some rustiness, which was kind of there on both sides. And then their passing as well was fantastic. I thought Schmitz settled into the team very well. Ianaga was very good. Tanaka had a superb game. And Kaoru Mitoma just continued from last season and was, yeah, he got his two goals. We got to see a bit of AR, which actually worked, so that was good. And yeah, first half couldn't have gone much better for Kawasaki, and I give a lot of credit to Gamba, because you could have folded at that stage. But second half, they were a different team. They sort of switched their tactics up a little bit. They kind of tried to go toe-to-toe a bit more with Kawasaki. They were a little bit more on the front foot, and they got their goals from that and made it into a really good game.
All right, superb stuff. And so, yeah, the Kaoru Mitoma's brace, a quick-fire brace, right around the half-hour mark, sent Kawasaki into the sheds, cruising 2-0 up. Mitoma opening the scoring in the 29th minute, and, 3 minutes later, made it 2-0. Of course, he had scored the winner in the team's last meeting in the Emperor's Cup final, when Kawasaki won 1-0 to complete a clean sweep of three wins from three against Gunma in 2020. So, Johnny, I guess, ultimately, if listeners don't know, you are a Gunma Osaka supporter. Ultimately, your side has lost the game, but I guess you've got to be really pleased with the reaction. You appear to have, as Sam said, tried to go toe-to-toe with Kawasaki in the second half, and you saw the fruits of that.
Yes, as you saw, as you said, like last season, Gamba lost three times to Kawasaki, and we didn't score a goal in any of those games. To actually, like you said, come out and have a go, it's a kind of sign, hopefully, of kind of turning over a new leaf. 2020 had like a very, very tough schedule, and Gamba's tactics kind of reflected that. Very happy to settle for one goal victories, but yeah, it's a new year, it's a new season. Gamba have kind of reinforced, and Miyamoto's talked a lot in the press about trying to utilise the attacking talent that is at the club. And yeah, I'm not big on reading too much into games like this Super Cup. So I see it more kind of as a competitive pre-season game against high quality opposition. And yeah, I think Gamba supporters won't be too sad to see Kaoru Mitoma off to Europe. But we got closer this time, so like you say, there's positives we can take.
All right then. So what about the lineups then? Johnny, well, I'll come straight back to you and your thoughts on the team that Tsuneyasu Miyamoto put out for Gamba. Obviously not a full strength team with not everybody available for this game, as we all know. It's just a curtain raiser. The winners obviously get to lift a trophy at the end of it, but apart from that, it's just a glorified pre-season friendly. So I don't know, were there any pleasant surprises for you? Perhaps maybe you turn it on its head and ask you if some players who ordinarily might not get a proper run out with the first team took their opportunity.
I'd say if you turn it that way, young Shuhei Kawasaki, playing against Kawasaki in the left wing, he is someone who's played with the under-23s the last couple of years in J3, and he kind of came into the first team at the end of last season when we had the injury crisis. Didn't really do a whole lot, but showed some nice touches. It was a pleasant surprise to see him in the starting lineup. I got a few messages kind of through my WordPress and Twitter about, like, Kosuke Onose at right back. He's not really a right back, but again, it's just kind of testing options because Miyamoto does like to kind of move players around or have players who can play in several positions. And I don't know if it's quite a pleasant surprise, but Shunya Suganuma, who did better than I thought he would do last year, I expected him to be like the fifth choice centre-back this year with Yota Sato coming in, but seeing him starting alongside Miura was quite a surprise for me.
All right, what about the Kawasaki side of things then, Sam? Oh, yeah, speaking of players playing out of position at fullback, the Reo Hatate at left-back experiment continued for Frontale on Saturday. Elsewhere, you mentioned Yao Schmidt is straight into the team at the heart of the midfield. Apart from that, were there any other standouts other than Mitoma, obviously, or surprises for you in the team that Toru Uniki put out?
Well, I think generally that Kawasaki team picks itself, and other than Nobori Sato would normally start at left back if he was fit, I think that was the only decision that had to be made. And Kurumaya has been tested out in this pre-season as a centre back, and kind of they wanted him to play centre back. I think probably in this game if they were going to, but he had to come on at left back in the end because there was like a concussion injury to Sukugawa. So yeah, the first concussion substitute used in Japanese football comes in the first game, and I've got reservations about the way that is, but that's for another episode. But yeah, Hatate was there. I think he looked quite uncomfortable. I don't think he's a left back at all, really. Like his passing out from the back caused a few problems right at the start of the game, and yeah, I don't think he was ever that comfortable. I mean, he's doing as well as he can there, but I think if this was a more important game, as Johnny said, not really a friendly as this is, I think Kurumaya would be playing at left back and Hatate would probably get back on the bench. But otherwise, I mean, yeah, that team was pretty. Everyone, I think, could have picked that team. Schmidt came in, and I mean, first half they were fantastic. Tanaka, I'd say, was the pick of the players. He got the assist for Mitoma's first goal. He was just a bundle of energy in that midfield because Schmidt. He's kind of like, I wouldn't say lazy, that's not the right word, but he kind of glides around there and he's not like a bundle of energy at all. He needs someone to run around him, and Tanaka kind of did that. He did the defensive side and the attacking side perfectly, and I thought, yeah, he just really stepped up, and he's going to have to this season with Nakamura and Morita out of that squad. So yeah, he was superb. And I thought Diatona, when he came on, he got the assist for the third goal. He's, as we've talked about him last week, his chances are going to be quite limited. But yeah, he looked really positive when he got on the ball. And it was a really nice through ball into Kobayashi for the winner.
Indeed, indeed. So we better give Gumba the players their due for the goals in the second half. Shinya Yajima made it 2-1 on the hour, and then Patrick equalised from the penalty spot 7 minutes later before the clairvoyant Jeff Osborne had called it. Kawasaki won it with literally the last kick of the game, Yu Kobayashi, in the 96th. minute, and Frontale got to raise another trophy at this time at Saitama Stadium. Sam, before we move on, you mentioned VAR. I guess it worked, but there was some confusion as there weren't replays shown of certain incidents. So how did it? I wasn't watching the game live, so I was relying on Twitter reactions from a lot of different people that weren't overly positive at the process. I think the decisions that were reached were accepted as correct, but we're used to watch people who watch the Premier League are used to getting replays while the review is underway. But apparently it wasn't the case on Saturday. So how did you find the introduction of VAR into J1?
Yeah, if you look at it as just was the decision correct and it wasn't made quite quickly, then yeah, it was absolutely fine. But yeah, as a presentation both to the TV viewers and to the people in the ground, it was just everyone was stood there not knowing what was going on. I think it was a shot from Yamane which Mitoma turned in, and he himself, I think, thought he was offside. And then everyone was just standing around. There was no replay at all. And at least the English commentator that we had on the YouTube feed that was sent over here, he hadn't got a clue what was going on. I don't know whether that was the same case for the Japanese commentary team. But, yeah, no, it was just a case of no one knew what was going on. It would just be so simple to just put up a replay so we can know what we're looking at, what's going to happen, and, yeah, kind of clue people in. But, yeah, that didn't happen, so... Yeah, that was a shame. So hopefully they can rectify that going into the league. And, I mean, they're going to be learning about the use of VAR for the rest of this season because they didn't have last year. They had, like, one match day to really get their heads around it. So, yeah, hopefully it will just be improved on each week. So the decision was fine, but the presentation, yeah, needs a lot of work.
All right, interesting times, most definitely in J1, yes, as VAR enters the fray. All right, well, we're breaking the rules somewhat here, listeners, on the final part of our J1 season preview. For up till now, for the first three episodes, we have previewed the teams in order as they appear, basically in J-League order from Sapporo down. So technically, we should begin this final five-team preview with Nagoya, but we're living dangerously, and instead we're going to begin with Johnny's team, Gumba Osaka. We've obviously just spoken about them a little bit. They were in action in Saturday's Super Cup. So, let's begin our preview with the black and blue half of Osaka, managed, of course, by Tsuneyasu Miyamoto, who took over from Levir Kulpi, and more on him later, at the halfway mark of the 2018 season, with the club in 16th place. And he hauled them all the way up to 9th. Indeed, they would have finished 6th had they won on the final day of the 2018 season. Gumba got off to another slow start under Miyamoto in 2019 before they ended up 7th. And then after some inconsistency again at the start of the season, they hit their straps properly and ended up in second place at the end of the 2020 season. A huge accomplishment, obviously 18 points behind champions Kawasaki, but well and truly the best of the rest over the course of the season. Johnny, before we get stuck in here properly, how are you feeling about Miyamoto? As I say, 2.5 seasons in, basically. Is he the right man to steer Gumba forward? How much confidence do you have in him of, bridging the gap between yourselves and Kawasaki and maintaining Gumba up at the top of J1?
It was actually interesting because last week you had Scott McIntyre on, and he mentioned what the main reason for having Gumba a bit lower this season was the coach Miyamoto, which actually surprised me a little bit because, I mean, I know he's probably not going to be up for like World Manager of the Year like this year, but obviously he's a Gumba fan's favourite as a club legend, and like you said, he took over in 2018 with Gumba seemingly heading for a second relegation of the decade. And I believe that season, the second half of the year, they only had the second best record in the league behind Kawasaki, who were champions. And then obviously last season, they had a very slow start. I believe they lost 8 of the first 11 games. Not last season, sorry, 2019. Mm. And then, but basically after that, they sort of performed at the level of about fourth or fifth in J1. And then obviously with Tokyo and Yokohama F Marinos having the Champions League distractions, they kind of maintained that over the course of 2020 with a lot of injuries. And yeah, I would have bit your hand off to get second in Emperor's Cup final place at the beginning of 2020. Of course, not knowing what was to come. But at the moment, Jurgen Klopp may be looking for work soon. But I'm quite happy with Miyamoto being in charge of Gamba.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Yeah, most definitely a fan favourite of all Gumba supporters, I'm sure. Okay, so to the major ins, Sam. Well, for me, yeah, they're up front. Obviously, again, you guys can fill in the other names around the fringes. But Leandro Pereira, Hiroshima's top scorer last season, has signed from J2 Matsumoto. If that sounds a bit strange, well, yes, Pereira was on loan from Matsumoto Yamaga to Hiroshima, and has a very impressive record in the top flight of 21 goals in 47 J1 appearances, while another Brazilian striker, Thiago Alves, has arrived from Tosu. His record not quite as impressive as Leandro's, but he's a very, very capable on his day, while Juse Jong comes in to the midfield from FC Seoul. So, Sam, firstly, before Johnny gets carried away on how he thinks all these three new signings are going to go, what's your take on them and how you think they might fit in?
Well, I think all the signings make sense. They weren't the highest scorers last season. They were a little bit passive in times, just kind of sitting on 1-0 leads, as we've said. But yeah, these two, Leandro and Thiago Alves, do give a lot of firepower. I think Leandro will probably take that berth at the centre forward. They have moved to a 4-3-3 in pre-season. They started that way at the weekend, then did change. So they've got different options there. I think Pereira would be flanked by Usami and probably Onose as the front three. I think that might be the way to go. And then, everyone knows Leandro's record last season. He was a terrific striker. Thiago Alves is a bit more of a joker in the pack, maybe. He spent a lot of time injured at Sagan Tosu. In fact, a lot of the clubs, at Shimizu he was, at Jeonbuk he was injured as well. But there's a very good player in there. I remember watching him in the K-League for Seongnam maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. And he was absolutely superb. So if they can kind of wrap him in cotton wool and then just use him as an impact sub, I think, he could be a terrific option for them. And then Juse Jong, they needed an extra midfielder. They were playing, well, especially when Idiguchi went out, injured at the end of last season. You're playing Yamamoto in there and Okano at times and Yajima. It was clearly a weak area for them. And Juse Jong comes in with a lot of experience at Seoul, a lot of experience for the ACL, which will help. I think maybe this signing is a year or two too late. I think his performances for Seoul have dropped off really after the 2018 World Cups. So hopefully he can reinvigorate himself and, Juse Jong at his best alongside Idiguchi is a terrific midfield. So I think, they've recruited really well, actually, and I think it gives them the best chance to attack both the league and the ACL.
All right, so, Johnny, how are you feeling about the... firstly, the options up front. I mean, you've lost, obviously, Adam Ilson after his very serious indiscretion, and Kazuma Watanabe has left the club as well. Both of them scored six league goals in 2020, which is the same number as Takashi Usami, while Patrick was obviously the leading scorer after a superb second half of the season. But, he only managed 9 to be your leading striker, whereas Leandro Pereira netted 15 in 26 appearances for Hiroshima last season. So do you agree with Sam that he's likely to, once properly bedded in, likely to be the starter? Ryan Cook's question was about this situation, wondering whether Leandro will play off the bench like he tended to do with Patrick last season while Adam Ilson was starting with Usami. So how do you think it's all going to shake out? Obviously, we know the ACL is a potential distraction, but only in that bubble. So for the most part, you're going to be playing weekend to weekend. So how do you think things will settle up front for Gumba?
Well, it's actually interesting because this year's schedule is quite uneven in places. I was kind of just checking before we came on. Gamba's first 10 league games are actually played in the space of like 43 days. And then you have like sort of months off later in the season. So I think I spoke to Sam about this on Twitter. Like initially I'd expect like Pereira and Patrick to essentially rotate starts, and you're not really clear which one is the main starter. And then as the season goes on, like I think Patrick will be 34 later this year. So I'd expect Pereira, the younger man, and obviously, like you say, a great goal-scoring record in J1, I would expect him to, he's going to be the one to take over that main starting role. One thing I think to note, like last season from watching all Gamba's games, they didn't score many goals, but there wasn't really many games where you felt like, well, they should have scored more goals. So it was more of a kind of team strategy thing and not creating enough chances, which hopefully the 4-3-3 can rectify, because there are enough attacking options at the club to score goals. It's just getting that kind of balance right. For example, Kawasaki did last year, or Marinos did the year before, of being able to do all-out attack where also keep things quite tight at the back. That's really where Gamba need to find the kind of extra motivation, extra room.
Just on that kind of balance question, you kind of had the problems, I thought, last year when you've got three very, very good centre-backs. And in an ideal world, I think you wanted to fit all three in the same formation. And it never really worked. So what would your solution be to that? Would you pick, which would be your pairing if you're going to go 4-3-3?
It might seem harsh on Miura because he's the captain, but I think fit and raring to go, Kim and Shoji are better centre-backs than Miura. And Miura can play right back, but it's a bit like you said about Hatate. It's not really his position playing as a fullback. You can kind of get away with them there for a little time. But I think, Shoji and Kim would be my first choice. But I have a kind of nagging doubt that Shoji's going to be in and out of the team again. I think he had three separate spells out of the team injured. So I think it's Shoji and Kim is the best choice pairing, but it's probably going to be Miura and Kim that play most of the games together, would be my guess.
All right. And so, Johnny, what about the, obviously, you're blessed with those three excellent centre-backs. What about the depth of the squad elsewhere? It's an ACL challenge, but you could be in and out of the ACL in 2 weeks, right, with this bubble taking place. So it might, obviously with the quarantines, this, that and the other, we don't know where it's going to be played yet. But, how deep is the squad? Are you satisfied with not only the additions up front and Jew in midfield, but elsewhere, have you, cut some dead wood and added some excellent stuff around the fringes? How are you feeling about the squad as a whole?
Well, another thing to consider is that Gamba no longer have their under-23 team in J3. Mm. So a lot of the younger players have either been kind of totally sold off or loaned out. And then the ones who have stayed, like Toyama, Tsukamoto, Kawasaki, are now dedicated to getting in the top team. It's definitely a big and deep squad, because one of the things I've noticed looking at all the teams, depth is always an issue in Japanese football, whereas Gamba were able to kind of blunder through that final part of the season last year with a lot of injuries, whereas, for example, someone like Sendai, that just crushed them having key players out. So definitely all of those players, as you said, like Leandro Pereira, Thiago Alves, Jussie Jong, potentially also Wellington Silva coming in after the state of emergency ends. Definitely going forward, there's a lot of depth. Kazunari Ichimi's back as well from Yokohama FC, so that's just going to switch for Watanabe. For the only area I'd say is concerned is maybe fullback, maybe right back, because Ryu Takao is the only actual right back in the squad. Yuya Fukuda is more of a right midfielder who can play wing back, same as Anose. And like I said, Miura can play there, Kohei Okuno can play there, but they're all players who have a better position elsewhere. So there's a player we'll come on to when we talk about Nagoya. I would quite like Gamba to sign, but generally, I think this squad is stronger than the one that started last season.
All right, and Sam, we're kind of, I think, undecided between us about how much of an impact we think the ACL will have. Johnny said the schedule will be a little bit congested at the start of the season, but I would argue that the players are used to that from last year. So, what's your overall feeling? We said we said last week, I mean, they finished 18 points behind Kawasaki last year, but they don't begin this season 18 points behind them. Everybody starts from scratch. So, yeah, how are you feeling? And I guess a kind of a rough guesstimate about where you have them finishing in your preseason table?
Yeah, I have them still as an ACL competitor. I've dropped them slightly to sixth. I've got Tokyo and Yokohama just going above them. I mean, there's not a lot to choose between a lot of those teams. I do think Gamba have improved, but then other teams around them have as well. The ACL is so difficult to determine how big an impact it is. This group stage, we don't know where it is. We don't know if they get through the groups. We don't have a clue how the knockout stages are going to be. Is that going to be back to normal, where they might be travelling down to Australia in a midweek and then coming back? We don't really know, so it's difficult really to kind of use that, I suppose. I've got them sick. I think they've got a good chance of getting at ACL positions, but yeah, more so I'd say Yokohama improving, and I think Tokyo would improve as well after their schedules last year. So yeah, they're all thereabouts for Gamba.
All right, and I guess you can have the final word, Johnny. That's only fair. How about yourself? Your own preseason expectations. I don't know. Do you think they are good enough to win it, or is this another season of consolidation in the top four, perhaps before I don't know? Maybe the stars might align somewhere a little bit further down the line.
Yeah, I would be very surprised to see Gamba winning the league. I mean, I guess, like we said, the ACL is the great unknown. If Gamba were to go out in the groups, it basically doesn't affect most of their season then. In that respect, they could go on and win it. I agree with Sam, though. I have them anywhere between third and sixth. The list I have down in front of me, I've gone very positively in third place, but those two teams you mentioned, FC Tokyo and Yokohama F Marinos, are right behind them. So I have them in a kind of block of teams that could finish anywhere between third and sixth. I would like to see top four and get back in the ACL, but yeah, I don't really see them challenging, for example, Kawasaki or Kashima ahead of them.
While I was spluttering through my answer, I was trying to think of a quote that I was trying to put in. It was from Shinya Yajima, actually, after the Super Cup at the weekend, and he spoke, like, he said, oh, we could tell that Kawasaki was so far above us and it was so difficult to get close to them. And I thought that was a really negative attitude for a player to have that finished second last year. If you have that inferiority complex on Kawasaki, you're never going to get to them. So I thought I hope that's not shared between the rest of the squad, and I hope it was maybe a bit of a misquote or something. But yeah, that kind of worried me when I saw the second place team have a player say, we're not going to be challenging the first team that came first.
I know, you get sort of rivalries between teams, and then in Japanese football, they all look very friendly before and after games, and there does seem to be a lot of respect and friendliness between Gamba and Kawasaki, which is kind of strange because they were the top two last year, that the players were all shaking hands and sharing a joke before the game. On Yajima, I was very happy to see him get the goal against Kawasaki, because in the 5-0 game last year, I mean, I don't want to pick on anyone, but he was particularly poor in the midfield, and we really missed Ediguchi on there. He didn't really put many tackles in, and Kawasaki were just kind of getting through him. So he started last season well, scored a goal against Marinos in the first day of the season, and to see him get another goal playing in that advanced role. So hopefully you're right in that was a misquote, and he's got a bit more confidence going into this year.
All right then, and before we move on off Gamba, Johnny, we had a reminder, I suppose, from Andrew Schmidt on Patreon that of his question from a couple of weeks ago, where he asked about a team's style of play. I guess if they don't have a definitive one, I guess the personality of the club again. Whether a neutral would want to get up on the other side of the world at 6 o'clock in the morning to watch this team play. So I don't know, I guess you're slightly biased, obviously you're a Gamba supporter, but so if you could the personality of Gamba, the way Sunayasa Miyamoto sets them up, the way they go about things, whether maybe this year you think they might be a little bit more expressive. They took Kawasaki on Saturday, where they were much more passive in the other meetings in 2020. So a little bit about the way your team goes about it.
Yes, it's quite a broad open question. So Gamba, obviously, are one of the and I'm biased, but I think most Japanese football fans would say Gamba are one of the biggest teams in J1, that they're a team that the fans would always expect to be challenging for, if not necessarily the title, but for getting in the ACL, playing a big new, well, 5-year-old beautiful stadium, one of the nicest in Japan. With Miyamoto, he's sort of been stung by kind of earlier poor runs of form, and last year I would kind of compare them to maybe Jose Mourinho era Chelsea, in that there's a lot of good talented players there, but maybe you don't want to get up at 6 a.m. in the morning to watch them. I watched all 34 league games last year, and I struggled to think of any I would enjoy watching the full 90 minutes back. Yeah, so hopefully, like, there has been a bit of criticism, because, like, Gamba supporters do expect a lot, and winning games 1-0 or 2-1, kind of grinding out, that didn't really change either between teams at the top of the league or the bottom of the league. They were quite happy to beat Shonan and Tosu 2-1. I think fans accepted it last year because of the nature of the schedule, playing through the brutal Japanese summer heat. But yeah, this year there's a bit of pressure to kind of, like I say, to get that balance right, get more attacking football. We've got Usami, Kurata, Onose, Pereira, Thiago Alves, Patrick, to name a few, Fukuda, Yamamoto. There's plenty of attack-minded players, so there's no reason why Gamba shouldn't become one of the more attractive teams in the league. But, I mean, obviously I didn't watch the Super Cup, so I don't know, Sam, if there's anything you'd like to add about how you felt they'd changed from last season to this year.
Yeah, I mean, in first half, you wouldn't know there was any change. It was still the same passive. They were quite happy to just kind of hold it as much as possible. But, yeah, the second half, it did, and the introduction as well of Leandro Pereira and Thiago Alves, it did signal kind of a shift to a bit more of a, we're going to go for it a little bit more. And hopefully that is the way that the Gamba play this season. The signings all look to be in that direction, and there is so much talent there. If they are switched on to a bit more of an attacking mindset, I think Gamba could be a really, really good team to watch. But yeah, there are going to be occasions, I think, where Gamba in a tight game are just going to dial it back a bit and just see games out. So yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily it's the team you want to be watching at 6 a.m, but there is the potential for the team you want to be watching at 6 a.m.
All right then. Okay, well, we'll move off for Gamba then. Well, thanks again for your question, Andrew, and we'll try to remember to mention it for each of the five clubs in this episode. We're talking about Gamba. We mentioned that they've gone for quality rather than quantity in terms of ins in the transfer market, and similar could be said of Nagoya Grampus, managed by Massimo Ficcadenti, who's beginning his second full season at the Toyota Stadium. He took over from Yahiro Kazuma for the final 8 games of 2019. He took the club after their 13th place finish in 2019, all the way up to third, and the ACL places in 2020, speared on by Mateus, of course, the electric Brazilian winger who many felt was unlucky to miss out on a spot in the best 11, which was, of course, dominated by Kawasaki players, somewhat understandably, I suppose. When you win the league by 18 points, you could arguably have the entire first 11. But in terms of their ins, I mentioned, again, quality over quantity. Basically, Sam, the way I see it, they've got two quality ins in each area of the pitch that has strengthened their squad. I'm not sure we're specifically with the ACL in mind or not, but they appear to have done some pretty shrewd business.
Yeah, I think we mentioned last week that maybe Shimizu had done the best, but I'd say Nagoya were a very close second. As you say, it's kind of with depth in mind. I think they've got now 2 players in every position, except for one gaping hole up front. But yeah, the signings, I thought Kimoto fantastic, because he can play centre-back, he can play holding midfield. You've got good options there. Morishita, I think, is the player that Johnny would want at Gamba. I think he is a terrific pickup for Nagoya. I thought he was really good, especially second half of the season for Sagan Tosu, so he should slot in nicely at right back. In more advanced roles in midfield, Kazuki Nagasawa doesn't necessarily strike you as the most glamorous of signings, but as a Ficcadenti signing, I think he's perfect. He can come in if Inagaki's injured or Yonamoto's injured. He will just play, does the dirty work. He's not afraid of a little niggly challenge in there. I think he's perfect for them. Manabu Saito on the left wing, that we've not seen the best of him since his injury, but I mean, he's a quality player on his day. And if you add him to the likes of Mateus and Maeda and Sommer, I mean, it's terrific options. And then up front, this is the only issue I have with them. They've got Kanazaki, who's going to miss the next 6 months, probably with his ACL injury. And they've brought in Yachiro Kakitani, who to me is a myth. Whenever I started watching Japanese football, everyone says Kakitani is a really good player. He's been to Europe. He's terrific. And I can't think of a game where I thought Kakitani looked good. So they stuck with him as their striker with Yamasaki behind him. So that is an issue, but they've got so much quality in and around that. I think, yeah, they've got probably out of any team, they've got the best depth. I think Kawasaki's first 11 is better and maybe first 15. But yeah, in terms of a full squad, I think Nagoya's is the strongest.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it, Johnny? Yeah, I mean, Ficadenti has a reputation as a very pragmatic manager. He gets results. He doesn't always have hordes of people praising him for the style of football he plays. But yeah, it's really interesting that they've gone for a couple of high grade reclamation projects, I would say, in Saito and especially Kakitani. I can completely understand what Sam's saying. I mean, at one stage, this fella was the future of Japanese football. He was the brightest spark coming through. I guess similar to Yoshinori Muto, another player who is obviously still over in Europe, but who shone so brightly on the J-League stage. It didn't pan out for them in Europe. Will it ever for Muto? I would argue no. Kakitani very quickly realised it wasn't going to work out for him, so he came back with his tail between his legs. But yeah, I mean, Sam's right. He just hasn't been the same since he's come back. But if Ficadenti can get something out of Saito and something out of Kakitani, then it will most definitely bolster, as Sam says, an already very, very strong-looking Grampus squad.
Yeah, definitely. I have more hopes for Saito than Kakitani. I think I was actually surprised. Saito's only 30. It always confuses me because some Japanese players go straight from high school into the first team and some go from university, like trying to work out who's what age. I think with having Matias, Soma, Hiroyuki Abe, Gabriel Javier, Saito is the perfect kind of player to kind of fit into a rotational system there. It might surprise people to know, as someone who became a Gamba fan, that the first game I ever watched in Japan was actually Cerezo versus Urawa back in 2013, and I believe Kakitani scored. And so Sam said he's a bit of a myth. I have actually seen evidence that he did exist in that form in the past. I was actually going to bring this up in the Cerezo part, but I think we had a question about Kakitani. It's probably the right time to talk about it now, because his reputation is built on that 2013 season, 21 goals with Levir Kopi's team getting into the ACL. Since then, he scored 15 J1 goals in 116 appearances. Best ever season total was 6 in 2017. One goal, one assist in 24 appearances, mostly from the bench last year. I think if you imagine that 2013 season, he scored 10 goals, would he still be a J1 player now? I have my doubts.
Yeah, well, that's great of you to mention Jamie Makel's question there on Kakitani. Yeah, how have you gauged the Cerezo fans' reaction to Kakitani leaving? I must admit, Twitter has not been ablaze, has it, Johnny? So I'm not sure if you can take the temperature of the Kansai area of they're not burning Kakitani kits down the Dotonbori, are they?
I don't think so, no. I think the question also mentioned like Yamaguchi and Sugimoto, and obviously Yamaguchi's still contributing at Kobe and going to a sort of neighbouring club. That was caused a bit of a ruckus, and obviously Sugimoto's move to Urawa has gone horribly wrong, but at the time he left, I don't think he's someone they'd want to leave. But yeah, Kakitani would be, 23, 24 when he was in his prime, and those days, I think, are long since gone. So obviously Cerezo supporters will have a special place for him in their hearts. But I think, a one-hour trek along the Shinkansen to Nagoya is not going to bring back 20-goal-a-season Kakitani, I'm afraid.
No, yeah, I tend to agree with you. All right, well, in my mention of two players in each position, or each area of the pitch, I was being a little bit cheeky because, Mu Kanazaki's loan from Tosu was turned into a permanent deal, so he's still showing up on the transfer lists, even though he obviously spent all of last year with the Grampus. But, yeah, Sam, as you say, he's going to miss a large part of this season. So, what are they going to do? How are they going to get by? We've just established that you can't really be relying on Kakitani these days. So what are they going to do up front to try and, get by, basically, until Kanazaki comes back? And then, obviously, that will put huge hopes on his shoulders, which they won't want to do as soon as he's back to fitness. So how do you think they're going to manage things?
Well, in an ideal world, Kakitani starts scoring goals, but let's not think that's going to happen. And they've got so much quality in and around them. I mean, Mateus was fantastic for the majority of last season. They were a little too heavily reliant on him, I think, at times. But, yeah, he's definitely got goals in him. And I think other players will chip in as well. Maida, he's a bit of a fits and starts player, but if he's in form, he can grab maybe 5 and 6, something like that. And then Abe is a terrific player. He can score goals. Soma can, Saito can. So they're all going to chip in and around the striker. And maybe Kakitani is like a player that is everything's played off him a little bit, more so than relying on the centre forward to score the goals. So I think that'll be the way they go. But generally speaking, a Ficodenti team is going to be defence first. They're not going to concede too many goals. That defence with Maruyama and Nakatani is terrific. It has been for the last couple of years. And then when you've got Langrak behind them, anything that gets through, he saves quite a bit of it. So Nagoya aren't conceding many goals, so that kind of allows them to maybe scrape by with 1 or 2 goals in a game. So I think that's probably going to be the way they go. And like, even when you get Kanazaki back, he's not really a massive goal scorer. He runs very well up front. He works very hard. But in terms of goal scoring, you can't really rely on him for much more than 10 a season, if that. So they're used to playing without that striker. So I think, yeah, that will be pretty similar to the way they set up last year.
All right. So we mentioned the ins. I guess the outs are headlined by Jao Schmidt, who, as we saw in the Super Cup, is slotted straight in to Kawasaki's midfield. But after Schmidt had started 8 of Nagoya's first 12 games last year, he only made one more start the rest of the way, as Ficodenti went with Sho Inagaki and Takuji Yonemoto whenever he was fit alongside Inagaki. So I guess, yeah, the loss of Schmidt will not be keenly felt, you wouldn't think, especially with the Nagasawa coming in from Reds. So, Johnny, Sam's mentioned Mitch Langerak there. We got a question on him on Patreon from Kevin. Obviously, Langerak and his defence set a very high bar for themselves last season as they set a new J1 record with the 17 clean sheets. That's one every other game if you're keeping track at home, listeners. Kevin asks, can Langerak do better than last year? And is it likely that he will continue to play with Nagoya in the long term?
I would say the quick answer to the first question would be no, but the longer answer would be because him and the defence did so well last year. Like you mentioned, Maruyama and Nakatani, they and Langerak played every minute of every game last year, which was a tremendous achievement. And then Inagaki, I think, in front of them, he only missed 24 minutes of the whole season. So having that core, solid core playing every week was so vital for them, I think. And this year, with obviously the extra league games and extra Champions League, I think then Kimoto becomes a very key player because he can play both centre-back and central midfield. They will have to rotate at some point and someone's probably going to get injured. So for those reasons, I would say it would be very difficult to see him get 17 clean sheets again, but I still expect them to have an elite defence. In terms of kind of looking back through his record, Langerak's a name I've known for a while because he was at Dortmund, but in Europe he didn't really play regularly very often. So he's obviously had regular football at Nagoya for 3 years. So I mean, I don't know him personally, but I would guess if he's happy in Japan, there's no reason why he wouldn't continue playing at Nagoya.
Yep, sounds reasonable to me. What do you think, Sam? As Johnny's mentioned, Nagoya were absolutely terrific, and a lot of their progress up the table last year was based on their excellent defensive record. Do you think they can, come anywhere close towards matching that clean sheet record again?
I mean, yeah, it's so difficult. It's such a good record, and it's going to be difficult for any team to go near that. But, I mean, the players are still there. If they can keep the same levels of fitness that they had last year, with a slightly reduced schedule, as it will be this year, despite the ACL, I think they could be up there thereabouts. The kind of style of play lends itself to clean sheets, and as long as those players are switched on, which I think they always were with Mariama at kind of being like the leader at the back there, everyone was always switched on. So yeah, I don't think they'll match it, but I think they'll be right up there. And in terms of Langerak himself, I think he's at 32 now. He's had his experience in Europe. I can't see him really being a player that's clamouring to go back, because I mean, he did okay there, but he didn't really set the world alight there. He's got a position here where he's definitely first choice goalkeeper. Every sort of interview I've ever seen with him, he seems quite satisfied in Japan, quite happy. So I'd expect him to stay for another few years. Maybe he goes to Australia towards the end of his career to retire, but I think Nagoya fans can enjoy Langerak for a few more years still.
All right, terrific stuff. So, yeah, the first two teams we're previewing on this episode, listeners, obviously finished the second and third in the table in 2020 and are involved in the ACL group stage play. We know that from the start. The next team we'll preview after our break is Cerezo Osaka, who have to negotiate a playoff before we know whether they're in the group stage or not. So, guys, before we move off these teams and again get to Andrew's question about Grampus' style of play, Johnny, I remember the question I was going to ask you before we moved off Gumba, and it's what does the ACL mean to Gumba supporters as a whole? Is it something you strive to get into? And once you're in it, how seriously do you think your club takes it? Because obviously Cerezo, who we're going to come on to, have been accused of not taking it particularly seriously in the past, and it simply been a distraction to their league campaign. But how important is it to you and, in general, other Gumba supporters, do you think?
I think it is pretty important. Obviously, like Gumba won the ACL back in 2008, and Gumba fans love to talk about the game against Cristiano Ronaldo and Wayne Rooney and Manchester United back then in the World Club Cup, and they had that great run in 2015 as well. It was interesting because at the end of last season, obviously, Vissel Kobe did very well in the Champions League, and then I think the Japanese Gamba fans on Twitter, some of them were kind of mocking Kobe getting knocked out. And then other fans were saying, like, our recent record in the ACL isn't good enough to mock other Japanese teams when they get put out. So I think that the fans will like, being put out in the group stage, especially with the group Gamba have got, I think that won't be deemed acceptable. Like, we don't expect to win it, but a good showing is something that they're looking for. And obviously those signings we mentioned previously, like Pereira, Alves, Juicy Jong, that they're all geared to being like big name players. Juicy Jong's got Champions League experience. So yeah, I think Gamba and Nagoya haven't been in the Champions League for a while, so I couldn't really say so much about them, but I'd imagine them and Kawasaki would take it very seriously. Cerezo, like you say, there's been accusations about what they've done before, but I'm sure we'll come on to that later.
We will indeed. All right, well, Sam, you can't tell us what the ACL means to Grampus fans because you're not one. How well do you think their squad is constructed for a proper crack at it, if indeed Ficcadenti does take it seriously? I mean, well, if they're going to be away in a bubble, you might as well take it seriously, right? So, how do you think they're constructed? Obviously, a huge hole up front that Kakitani will try and, be a square peg in a round hole, we don't know, but how do you think they're constructed for it? And then if you could, I know you're very good at segues, if you could segue on to Andrew's question about Grampus' style and whether that's suited to the ACL, what it's like to watch them week in, week out in J1. Obviously Ficcadenti has a defensive reputation, but he got the best out of Mateus last season, so a lot for you to unpack there, mate.
Yeah, well, I'll start with just the Champions League as a whole. I think you hit the nail on the head there with the centralised group. I mean, you've already travelled. You've already got all your players there. So why would you not take it seriously? So I think even Cerezo this year, if they get into the group stage, I think they're going to play their main team for the bulk of the games. I mean, you've got to rotate anyway. But I think in terms of that, when you're playing, what is it, probably six games in 2 weeks, it might be, or something like that, I think you need a depth, a lot of squad depth, and I think Nagoya are perfect for that. I think they've shown last year that they can play. Their main players, as Johnny mentioned earlier, Maruyama, Nakatani, Inagaki, they don't need rests. They play through it. They keep their levels of performance. And in those forward areas where you might need a bit more rotation, they've got so many options. So I think they are kind of perfectly suited to the Champions League. And I think their style of play lends itself to Champions League games, especially when if they get through to the knockout stage. You always, there's kind of like the kind of, cliche maybe, that away from home in a last 16 game or something, you need to be really good defensively, you keep it tight, you might nick a goal. And that is kind of the way that Nagoya play anyway, so it kind of lends itself quite nicely to that sort of situation, if that is indeed how the last 16 works. But even in the group stage, I think they're a team that is going to be really difficult to break down. And a lot of the teams this year, I think, in the ACL are kind of a little bit down on firepower. I think the Chinese clubs, with the whatever's going on in the Chinese league, they're losing some of the players. They don't quite have the firepower that they have in previous years. I think the same can be said for the Korean teams as well. So I think a really solid defence is perfect for the Champions League. Whether they've got enough about them to go on and win it, I'm a little doubtful, but I think they'll have a good showing. And yeah, I think they've got the right style of play that will really suit itself to the Champions League.
All right. So, what about in top flight in Japan? Then the defensive stylings of Ficadenti, but a bit of swagger from Mateus and Gabriel Xavier every now and then. Are they a decent enough watch?
Yeah, as I said, if I'm saying that they're defensive, that's the first thought to them. But it doesn't mean that they're boring to watch. I quite like the way that Nagoya play. I think it's quite. If you're really interested in the tactical side of it, I think they're really good. I think if you watched the game against Kawasaki last year and the way that they nullified them and got that victory, I think it's really exciting for me as a bit of a nerd. It's quite exciting to watch. But then they've still got the flair. You've still got the individual brilliance of players like Mateus, like Saito if he plays to this level. Gabriel Xavier can bring something pretty special to the table. So I think, as defensive as they are, and that's their first thought, there's so much quality in the attacking areas. I think there is enough for a little bit for everyone in this Nagoya team.
Good stuff. All right. Well, 13th all the way up to third in 2020, Johnny. What are your thoughts about Grampus and where you think they might finish in a roundabout way in the new campaign?
I think when we're talking about Gamba, I mentioned that I had Gamba and FC Tokyo and Yokohama F. Marinos in a kind of group of teams that could come between third and sixth. Nagoya is the other team I've got there. I've actually got them written down sixth just now. I almost feel like if you took that team we've been talking about and if you stuck Everaldo or Leandro Damian as a centre forward, you have a team that could genuinely win the league. I just, over the course of 38 games plus ACL, I just can't see. Like, the other players are all good enough. Matthias is a great player, one of the best in the league, and Maeda and Abe, those goals. I just think they're going to fall short in a couple of games. They're going to draw 0-0 or 1-1 where they should really have won. So I have them in that kind of third to sixth group. Again, depending on, like, Sam's made a very good case for them going far in the ACL. That could kind of push them down to sixth, whereas in an early exit, you could be looking at third, maybe even second at a push.
All right, fair enough then. And Sam, it's obviously the great unknown at the start of the new season, and yeah, it's a good point from Johnny. But where do you have them in your table at the moment?
Yeah, I think I'm quite similar to Johnny in that I think we've got the same four teams that could finish between third and sixth. I've got Nagoya at fourth. I just think they've got a little bit more of a squad depth than the other teams around them. I think they can rely on their defence a lot more, so they're not going to. I don't think they're going to lose too many games. Like, if you take Yokohama, for instance, I think they will lose games because of their defence. So, yeah, I've got Nagoya in fourth, but as I say, and Johnny said, third to sixth is a bit of a lottery.
All right, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to watch full year two of Ficadenti Grampus, and obviously with the ACL thrown in, that just adds to the intrigue. All right, so we're two-fifths of the way through the final five teams in our preview. After a quick hit of music, we'll be back to talk about the other half of Osaka. Welcome back next to Cerezo Osaka, who begin 2021 under the stewardship of Levir Kulpi. If that sounds familiar, that's because it's the Kulpi is beginning his fourth stint in charge of Cerezo. Previously, he managed them all the way back in 1997. Then, between 2007 and 2011, he returned for the final 11 games of the 2012 season to put out a fire. And now he succeeds Miguel Lortina, who has departed after 2 years and headed to Shimizu. Johnny won't want to talk about this, but Kulpi, of course, also infamously managed Gamba for the first half of the 2018 season. As previously mentioned when we talked about Tsuneyasu Miyamoto, they were 16th at the halfway mark of the season when he was sacked. Yeah, Cerezo Osaka obviously sending Kulpi in as a double agent, and yeah, it almost worked. Cerezo finished fourth in 2020 and, have qualified for the ACL playoffs. Obviously, after Kawasaki won the Emperor's Cup, they would have been in anyway, obviously, because, they beat Gamba in the final. But to say it's been a head-scratching off-season is a massive understatement, Sam. So what we'll do to begin this section is I'll ask you Jamie Makel's question, and it's a very simple one, but it's a very good one concerning their transfer activity. What on earth have they done?
Well, I think it's the only question to ask, isn't it? I mean, yeah, where do you start? I think last week we spoke about how Lotina was not really liked at Cerezo. They did well with him, but they weren't exactly keen on his style of play. So they've definitely changed from that. I think someone in the board was looking at getting like a greatest hits together because they got Kulpi back. They brought in Okubo. They were definitely clearing the way to try and get Shinji Kagawa back. And then that didn't work. And then they had to go and, I don't know, they picked from all over the place. I mean, it's such a ridiculous array of signings that they've made. I think there are some good ones in there. Harakawa, I think, will add to their midfield as, set pieces is fantastic. He's got a little bit about himself. And then they've gone up front with Adam Taggart, who can't get into the country at the moment. But not last season, he didn't have the greatest year at Suwon. But the year before, he was top scorer. He was getting into the Australian national team. So you'd think if he starts with Kiyotaki and Sakamoto, that's terrific signing. And then at the back, you've got Ryosuke Shindo, who I really like, but had a bit of injury problems at the end of last season. He's carried them on to this season. But that's the area that's going to be a concern for me, the centre-back area. Mate Jonjic is gone. I think of all players, of anyone really in the J-League, he's kind of one of those quite irreplaceable. And they've not really replaced him with any quality. They've got our friend Dankler in from Vissel Kobe, who is not quite as bad as everyone makes out, but he's not good by any stretch of the imagination. And their other kind of defensive signing, and I think this kind of sums up the way Cerezo's window has gone. They announced a few weeks ago the signing of Thiago Pagnussat, who's a centre-back from Ceará in Brazil. But basically, Ceará have said, no, you haven't signed him. He's still our player. They've continued to play him in the Brazilian league. They're saying, well, if you want him, you're going to have to pay for him. So I don't know what the confusion is here. Last I heard, I think yesterday, there's a meeting scheduled for the 1st of March where Thiago will decide whether he's going to go to Cerezo or he's going to stay in Brazil, because there's obviously the confusion around the visa situation. Can he get into Japan? So if he doesn't go, and I mean, that defends really. Dankler, Seko I quite like, but otherwise Shindo's injured and the other signings and other players in that position are not too great, so that's a real issue. They've also signed Dang Van Lam, the Vietnamese goalkeeper. I mean, I've been a long advocate for Vietnamese players coming into the league, but I was thinking of better players than the goalkeeper. I don't think he's going to usurp Kim Jin-hyun, so that's another odd signing. And then that's before you even get onto the signings of Jeff players. I mean, Hirotaka Tameda, he was on the fringes, really, at Jeff. He's played in J1 before with Avispa and Oita and not really done anything. And then he got injured. I think he's out for, 3 months already with an ankle injury, so that's not gone very well. And the rest of the signs, like Kato from Kanazawa, it's just kind of average. Matsuda from Kofu again. I don't think any of these are going to turn up anything. So it's really all over the place. And Yoshito Okubo, what is he doing back in J1? I mean, it's great to see the Yoshi meter back. I don't think it'll be used very often, but it's great to see it back. But 38-year-old striker, their options up front are so limited because we've seen Kakitani go. Bruno Mendes has gone to Avispa. They got rid of Ken Tokura. They got rid of Koji Suzuki. So they cleared the way for Taggart, who can't get in the country. So they're stuck now with Toyokawa, who had that one fantastic goal, but that's all he ever did. And you've got a 38-year-old Okubo. So it's just weird. I mean, I can't get my head around it. I don't think anyone can really get their head around it. I think their first team still on paper is quite good. But yeah, behind that, I think there's a bit of a shambles.
yeah, that's very well surmised, I think, Sam. And obviously, Johnny, as a rival supporter, you must just be rubbing your hands together because, they ran you pretty close for second, obviously, last season. But, one of the more head-scratching J1 off-seasons in recent times. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are big raps for Riki Harakawa. He's an excellent player. His set pieces are always on point, as the kids like to say. But, I don't know. Along the same lines as Sam, it's really hard to see any kind of any sort of planning here that that makes any sort of rational sense for keeping a team up at the sharp end of the top flight.
Yeah, it's interesting to contrast them with Gamba and Nagoya, because we've basically gone through a second, third, fourth from last season, and we seem all to agree that Gamba and Nagoya, you can see what they're doing. They're kind of building depth. They're filling in areas generally where they were weak. I believe that the J2 guys in their preview, they were talking about Matsumoto and saying, like, they signed so many players, like, what are they trying to do? I feel a bit like Cerezo are similar to that. But, yeah, obviously everyone knows I'm a Gamba supporter, so I don't want to completely have a go at Cerezo. So I kind of wondered, because when Kulpi came in at Gamba, he did try and make the team a lot younger. We still, at that time, had a lot of players from the kind of 2014 treble-winning team. And Cerezo obviously have one of the better kind of youth systems in the country, but under Lottin, obviously, it wasn't really be getting used, other than obviously Seko at centre back. So there's, as Sam was mentioned, the lack of options in attack. But there's young Shota Fujio scored a goal against Urawa last year, where he kind of embarrassed Nishikawa. He did very well for the under 23s, I know, in J3, and also Jay Nishikawa as a kind of young attacking midfielder. So I wonder if the kind of rationale behind bringing Kulpi in is to use that youth system a bit more. In terms of, but Taggart is someone I don't know a whole lot about, but I think he's going to have to score more goals than Bruno Mendes, because, like we said at the back, that they're not going to be as tight as they were last year, even if they still do have Kim and Seko and Riku Matsuda and Marahashi Fujita. So, like Sam said, the starting 11 is still pretty good. There's a decent 13, 14 players there. If they get injuries, though, and then they're going to kind of like Jeff players or Riki Matsuda, I'm not sure how that's going to turn up. But, yeah, I think there's some decent promising young players coming through we may see later on in the season.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I thought that Kulpi would be bringing those players in, but I've looked at the pre-season so far, and the only kind of youngster that's playing is Ryuyun Nishio, who's a 19-year-old centre-back, but that's just because every other centre-back is either not at the club or injured. I mean, Fujio hasn't played at all, which is surprising. I thought, I assume maybe there's an injury there, but you would expect him to play, and really, his first choice 11 is pretty much what you'd imagine it was. It's the same as last season, just with Harakawa coming in into midfield. So, yeah, it hasn't really changed too much on the face of it. Just in terms of personnel, I'm sure the style they'll be a lot more expressive, a lot more open, just in terms of losing Jonic, but just as well as the way that Kulpi is going to play. So, yeah, I'm surprised that there's not more youngsters coming in, but that's kind of what he did at Gamba. When things were going wrong, he just went to more young players and more young players and more young players. So I wonder if that is just the way that Cerezo are going to go. Because, yeah, like, in terms of the swap of, when we were talking about Shimizu last week, they've got Lottina. So they've changed from this kind of open style to a more defensive one. I think that'll improve them pretty much straight away. The way that Kulpi is going to play, it's going to weaken this team straight away. It might improve as time goes on, maybe, but I think they're going to go down quite a bit. They might be mid-table or lower mid-table after maybe 10 games, and it's just, does he then panic in the way that he kind of did at Gamba, or does he believe in his way and then bring them up? So, yeah, they're going to be a really interesting watch this season.
Well, yeah, a question from Akakichino11, who echoed Jamie's initial question. He said he has a hard time understanding what Cerezo have done this off-season. Akakichino11 asks, do you expect them to be better than bottom half? I guess it's quite a drop, Johnny, from fourth to what would be obviously be 11th this year, wouldn't it, with 20 teams in J1. We've seen, just last season, we've seen Grampus obviously rise from 13th. So we know, huge swings from season to season are, most definitely possible. So, again, you're not much of a banter merchant. I'm very much in the same boat. So you won't, as you said, you're not reveling too much in Cerezo's, patchy off season because you don't want to reverse jinx anything. But, I don't know. Do you think they can still manage a top half finish, despite all the upheaval in this off season?
I'd compare them to, you guys were talking about Kashiwa, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and you said that they've regressed, but how many teams behind them are going to overtake them? So obviously, from fourth place, there's a few teams like Tokyo and Mariners will go straight past them. I have them kind of in a group of like teams between about 7th and 10th. So and there's a couple of teams we'll talk about later that are in that group as well. I have those about eight teams that I could realistically see getting relegated, and Cerezo are not one of them. And then I have a couple of teams like Urawa and Shimizu, who I think will be mid-table. I can't really see any of those 10 teams finishing above Cerezo. So, I don't have them in the bottom half of the league. I don't have them in the Champions League again, but I don't. One thing, though, that kind of does concern me slightly is if you look at Cerezo's history, although I've got them smack bang in mid-table and 10th, their history doesn't actually have a lot of mid-table finishes. They tend to have a couple of very good seasons followed by a shock relegation, a couple of years in J2 and then straight back to the top of J1. Yeah, so yeah. If I was to sleep now till the end of the season and someone woke me up and told me one of this year's ACL teams went down, it would be Cerezo, but I can't in good conscience put them down just now.
Yeah, that's very well said. An interesting point. Yeah, they're very much a hit and miss, aren't they, Cerezo? And you could argue they've laid the foundations on quicksand for another vaster slide down the table. But Sam, what do you think? Obviously, we thank Jamie and Ralph for their questions on Cerezo, and obviously Jamie, Johnny had answered part two of your earlier question about Kakitani earlier, so we appreciate that. And Jamie goes on to say it'll be interesting to watch Cerezo this year, no question. So Sam, where have you got them roundabouts?
Yeah, I've got them ninth. I think pretty similar to Johnny. I think it's just a case of how poor everyone is below them. I think you just look at their 11 and you'd hope that no matter what the manager is, no matter what he's doing, those players can still get results. I think Kiyotaki Sakamoto, they relied on them last year a lot. I think they will do this year. And I think they're good enough to keep themselves in the top half. I think they will drop down just because their defence is a lot weaker now. But, there's just so many teams below them. And you just look at them. Is anyone going to overtake them out of a Tosu or an Oita? I you wouldn't think so. So, as good a point as it is from Johnny, a really interesting one that Cerezo don't usually finish in mid-table. I think, this is the season for that to happen. But, again, if you're going to pick a big team to go down, if you had to pick one, it'd be between Cerezo and Urawa for me.
Ooh, okay. Well, that's just got Ralph's blood boiling a bit, I think. But I'm not going to touch that one because as a Tokyo supporter. But that's a fair point. I will say to move off that. So to Andrew's question about style of play, et cetera, it's an interesting one, obviously, with a new coach coming in, and I guess with Jonic leaving and hugely weakening the defence, could be likely to be a more attacking, almost certainly more attacking in philosophy than Lotina. So I don't know. This could get a bit to Keystone Cops at times, couldn't it, Johnny? I mean, they're trying to attack, but there's not much happening behind them. So it could be they could be a really interesting watch this season for good and for bad.
Yeah, well, obviously, last season and the season before under Lottie, they were definitely not a team to get up and watch at 6 o'clock in the morning. But yeah, they could go either way this year. I think I got my new soccer Mekan last year and I had them playing a kind of 4-2-3-1. And it's interesting, Sam said about young Nishio, the centre back, playing at the back. I saw him play a couple of times against Gambas under 23s last year, and he actually does look like a pretty decent player. I remember getting smacked in the face with the ball in the away derby and getting up, so he's obviously a pretty strong boy as well. Yeah, cool piece style. Yeah, it's up in the air, but I think they could be very, very interesting team to watch. So definitely more so than the last couple of years, but maybe not quite as successful as they've been under Lottina.
Yeah, so I reckon Jamie, he might be watching through his hands at times, but yeah, it's going to be very interesting, as he himself says. And we'll see how it goes in the Kulpi's fourth stint at the club. That's that's got to be a record in J1, I'm sure. All right, we'll move slightly to the west and talk about Vissel Kobe, still managed by Atsuhiro Miura, who took over at the helm in late September of 2020. He replaced Marcos Vives, who won his one and only game in charge after he himself had replaced Thorsten Fink. Vives will become, I'm sure, an answer to a pub trivia quiz in the future. Yeah, winning his one and only game, and I think it was 4-3 as well, wasn't it? So Vives, he lived fast, and he didn't die, but he went away very quickly. Miura is obviously still there, I suppose, Sam, just because they haven't been able to get a new Galactico manager into the country. Or did Miura do enough for you in the latter stages of 2020 to suggest that he deserved another chance and might be able to take them forward?
No, I don't think so. I think they didn't. They lost pretty much every league game that they played towards the end of last season. They turned up in two Champions League games and played okay, or pretty well in a couple of them, but then generally were pretty poor. But, I mean, it doesn't really matter who the manager is. It seems to follow the same pattern at Kobe. They did try and go for Shigetoshi Hasebe from Avispa, but he turned them down, according to all reports. And then I assume it's just they wanted a foreign manager, that they don't want to be in the same boat that Tokushima are, where their manager's not in the country. So they're just keeping on Miura because they know they're going to change manager at some point in the season anyway. So why not just continue with him? I mean, he's a sporting director. He's not a manager. I don't think there's any direction at the moment with Kobe. They're just kind of muddling along a little bit, and they'll make a signing maybe in May or something and bring in a new manager. But yeah, just they don't look like they're going anywhere. They really annoy me. They last season, and it's an excuse that Kobe fans, you see it all over Twitter, they were only cared about the ACL last season. That's what they'll tell you. But they were poor in the month leading up to the ACL, but for the rest of the season, they weren't very good. They won 9 out of 28, and I mean, that's not a team. That's not a result that this team should be getting. You see the players and the outlay and the money they've spent on them. You've got Iniesta, Sakai, Vermaelen, Furuhashi. That team should never be in the bottom half of the table, whatever you think their aims are for the season. And they've not really addressed anything. I mean, they've brought in a new goalkeeper just to join the collection of pretty poor goalkeepers. They've signed Shion Inoue, who's a good young midfielder from Tokyo Verde, but probably not going to be in the first team. And the main signing is this Lincoln guy from Flamengo. He's 20 years old. He was quite highly touted. There was a lot of a bidding war. I think there were FC Cincinnati were trying to get to him. He was offered out to a Cypriot team, and Huddersfield were trying to get to him. So it's quite a collection of teams. I mean, he's only 20, he's supposedly a very, very good player. So I spoke with the guys who work on Brazil here, and basically he seems to be one of these kind of party goers. He loves to go out, he likes to get himself into all sorts of shenanigans. He's been kicked out of the club a few times, just removed from the squad. So yeah, you've brought potentially a very talented player, but one that may disrupt things, and you're going to have to deal with him. Maybe moving into a dressing room with Iniesta will help him. But at the moment, he's a 20-year-old who can't get into a country. He seems quite bored. If you look at his Instagram page, he's quite unhappy with things at the moment. So it's a really interesting one when he eventually gets there. How well does he apply himself? Because it does seem like he has a lot of talent, and if he is like as good as he could be, I mean, it's a fantastic signing for them. But yeah, otherwise, there's not a lot that's happened. They haven't dealt with their defence at all. They've got Kobayashi back, who was on loan at Yokohama. But really, I think the same problems still exist at Kobe.
Well, yeah, this Lincoln sounds a very interesting prospect. And just to clarify, Sam, you said he got kicked out of the club. Was that the nightclub or the football club?
I assume one led to another.
I see. Very well done. All right. Well, yeah, so another local rival of yours, Johnny. The self-described number one club in Asia. Well, I guess they got fairly close last season after a decent run in the ACL. Although, yes, Sam's right. Their performances as a whole in the bubble weren't especially noteworthy, but they did make it through to the semi-final, didn't they? In the East, well, in the whole thing, in the East region final. So, Akaki Gino 11 asks, will they finish in a single-digit place in the J1 in 2021? Unlike most years, there have not been any high-profile signings for them, maybe Lincoln aside, yet although Ralph found some of their young talents quite promising last season. So do you think some of those will be allowed to flourish under Miura?
Yeah, I think, so me and Sam have basically agreed on everything up to this point. I think there might be a bit of disagreement with Kobe. I actually have them, I think they will finish in the top 10. I have them in a group kind of between 7th and 10th, again with Cerezo, Kashiwa and Hiroshima, potentially even 7th or 8th. I kind of divide them into two parts. The players they have, I actually really like, and I think they seem to have got younger. A few of the kind of younger players did quite well in the Asian Champions League. You've got like Goke and Yasui, Yamakawa. One player is maybe a bit left field I quite like is Daiju Sasaki, who, when I first saw him, I think he played against Cerezo. He looked like a kind of alternative to Sergi Samper, but then they had him playing on the wing. They've still got Furuhashi there. If Lincoln can stay away from the bars that Adam Olsen used to frequent in Kansai, again, you could have someone on the other wing who could do a good job. And I think we mentioned him earlier, Hotaru Yamaguchi. I think I actually saw him that Opta's J1 team of the year, Yamaguchi, on his stats, was actually in the best 11. So I think the talent's there. Obviously, Sam did a very good job of mentioning earlier that off-field, I don't really have much positive to say with them off-field. And yeah, I'd forgotten that Marcos Vives, Marcos is his first name, was even in charge for one game. One thing I just wanted to mention and can ask you guys about was, because you did Alan Gibson on a few weeks ago, and he, I think the word he used was Kobe couldn't give a toss. But forgive me if that's not the correct expression he used about the league. I'm not a Kobe supporter, but I actually quite like Kobe. I've got a bit of a soft spot. It's a very nice place. If anyone's like listening from outside Japan, I highly recommend visiting Kobe after COVID. But that kind of comment slightly angered me on behalf of Kobe fans. Like, how should you feel if you bought like a fan club membership, uniform, tickets, the zone package, and your team's, I believe what the Americans say, phoning it in for over half the season? Like, what kind of way is that to run a business? I would, on behalf of them, I would ask the sort of people running the club, like, who do you consider to be your rivals? And they might say, like, Kawasaki, Gamba, Marinos, whoever. So would any of them consider finishing 14th in league behind, like, Sagan Tos, who've got no money and had a COVID spell out with COVID and had to play other fixtures in a row at the end of the season? Is that really acceptable? So I felt if you're a Kobe fan, you have a right to be kind of angry at your club. They're a well-supported club in a big city, and I think those fans have a right to kind of deserve better from their club. So I don't know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I don't think it's true for a start. I don't believe that you are not paying attention to the league all season just because you've got a competition down the line in November. I don't think in May you're thinking, oh, I can't be bothered with this. I've got a Champions League to prepare for. I think that's nonsense. And even if it's true, how can you possibly... Yeah, how can you justify that to your supporters? That, yeah, we're not trying in this. We don't care. You can pay your money to come and watch us, but we're not going to give anything. It's just whichever way it is, it's really not the way that this team should be. There is no way that these collection of players should be any lower, in my opinion, than fourth. the amount of money that they pay, they should be challenging for the league every season. Last year, they were at lower mid-table. Every other season, they've been in and around 7th to 10th. And while that is just what Kobe did anyway, before the outlay of money. So, yeah, I just don't see where they're going. This team should be Champions League. And I think anything less, if I as a Kobe supporter would be furious that my team is playing so badly and I'm watching these players either not care or just not be performing anywhere near their level. So, yeah, Kobe supporters, I think, should be demanding more and not just be really happy that we've got Iniesta playing for our club.
Yeah, I completely agree, and very well said by the both of you there. I mean, it just reflects really badly on the playing group and also on the, I think, the culture of the club. And I think that's perhaps underrated at times in Japanese football, the... what goes on behind the scenes, the professionalism of the staff, of the coaching setup, this, that, and the other. I mean, there's plenty of times when Kashima have not had the strongest squad on paper, but they've just gone and won the league because that's just what they do. That's part of the culture, and however that started, there's something in the water up there, and it appears that, unfortunately, as beautiful a city as Kobe is, there's just something in the water there where it comes to the football. And Sam's absolutely right. They should be Champions League every season, and how these players could look themselves in the mirror at times is. It's beyond me because, the collection of talent, we've rarely seen anything like it. The results have just been absolutely, not up to scratch at all. I mean, eighth in 2019 and then, obviously sliding all the way down to 14th last year was absolutely dreadful. And, we know they have the players. We know they have the squad on paper. We know that Nagoya finished 13th. In 2019, and they rose up to third in 2020. Is that possible for Kobe? Yes, it's possible. But how many years in a row have we said, they'll do better this next season, and we're yet to see it. So I don't know if you're a brave man with a little bit of extra money burning a hole in your pocket. Then I don't know. Stick a tenner on Kobe at goodness knows what sort of odds you could get on them winning the league, because is it completely out of the realms of possibility? Well, it almost is, they have arguably one of the best three or four most definitely squads on paper. So if it all clicks, if somehow it all clicks, I don't know, I can't see it myself, but they could be the bottom half team to make the biggest leap. We'll wait and see, but certainly there's no evidence that they're going to do it, but one of these years, who knows, it might click. But it's a really interesting point, Johnny. Okay, and so before we move off Kobe, Sam, what can you tell us about their style of play under Miura? Obviously, they've got one of the best footballers to ever play the game in the centre of the park, who obviously has had his fitness concerns, but I think it was 23 appearances in 2019, and then he got up to 26 last year. So he's not ever present, but he's been managed fairly well through his 2.5 years in Japan, Andres Iniesta. Obviously, there are other big names. You've mentioned some of them already yourself. So, you've also mentioned at times how their football is vegetarian. I don't know. It's got all the calories sucked out. It's just all the passing around in midfield with no end product. So, I don't know. Can you see any sort of ray of light? Is it worth getting up to watch them? I think I know what you're going to say. I don't know. Players to watch out for, perhaps? Furuhashi's always a fun watch, isn't he?
Yeah, I'd always get up to watch Kobe because you have no idea what's going to happen. It's not going to be boring. I think if your idea is to get up to watch Iniesta, maybe wait a few months because he got injured in the ACL, so he's not going to be there for the start of the season. You might want to be tuning in April, something like that. I mean, the Kobe style of football, they have strived for this Barcelonification. That's what they're trying to address it as. And it's basically they will pass you they'll try and pass the teams to death. They will just keep possession. Usually they'll go nowhere with it, which is just frustrating to me. I mean, they have a maybe 60-70% possession, but don't go anywhere. They don't understand that there has to be an end product to it at times, and they only seem to have, it only seems to work for them when they have their trio of Sakai, Iniesta, and Furuhashi down the left wing. That seems to be the only time it ever really works in a positive manner. And they don't understand the second half of the way that Barcelona played under Guardiola in terms of the pressing when they're off the ball. A Barcelona team would lose the ball, and then everyone would be rushing to get it back. Kobe forget about that and just give up when they lose the ball, and then they're cut through so easily. I mean, you're going to see comical defending at times. Generally, if Hiroki Ikura is in goal, make sure you get up for that game, because he's going to be on the halfway line somewhere and it's going to go in. I mean, but if they click, and the occasions that they do click, I'm thinking back to the Suwon game right at the start of last season where they won, and then the other game in the ACL, I can't remember who they played against, but there's such quality in there, and when the passing moves do work well, and when you have Furuhashi at his best going forward, he's definitely the player I'd consider watching at Kobe. I'm sure pretty much everyone would agree with that. Furuhashi is a terrific player. So when that's working and Furuhashi's at his best, I mean, Kobe can be a really good watch going forward, but too often they're pedestrian in the way they play. They've got no real purpose. Whether that is a mentality thing that they aren't caring about the league or the games as much as they should be, but yeah, it's a little bit too passive. But yeah, it could be so good. So I'd still watch them. You're going to get something at the back usually to keep you interested, and maybe on their day, Kobe can be a very good team going forward.
Yeah, all right. Well, Andrew, I'm not sure if that's really especially convinced you, but yeah, they are definitely. Well, yeah, it's in some respects a train wreck, which is some people will always crane their neck to watch, won't they? But we'll wait and see. Johnny, Vissel have been the lowest finishing Kansai club since 2018. So the last three seasons, Gamba and Cerezo have finished above them in each of those 3 years. Will that pattern continue in 2021, or do you think Cerezo will slide far enough and Kobe will rise just far enough that they won't be the worst off of the three Kansai clubs this season?
Yeah, I actually have on the table I've got written in front of me, I have Kobe in 7th and Cerezo in 10th, but they're both in a sort of group with Kashiwa and Hiroshima where it could kind of go around. But yeah, I think Kobe have enough and Cerezo have slipped enough that Kobe will overtake Cerezo. Just an interesting point on the kind of Kansai derbies, because obviously Gamba play Kobe this Saturday. Kobe played 4 times against Gamba and Cerezo last year, didn't score any goals. But they scored 3 goals 3 times against Yokohama F. Marinos, so that might be something to kind of bear in mind. You have no idea what you're going to get with Kobe, so I have no idea. Like you said, Kobe could win the league. They could come 15th. And neither of those things would surprise me.
Yeah, well, so that's it. You never know what you're going to get. Life is like a box of chocolates, etc., etc. I think that's how it went, wasn't it? I haven't seen Forrest Gump for a while, but yeah. All right, we'll wrap up our J1 season preview with the last of the 20 teams we have to touch on, and it is Sanfrecce Hiroshima. Of course, in the past decade, a 3-time J1 champion, they look like becoming a dynasty themselves in the early 2010s before I guess they were superseded by Kawasaki, who themselves have now obviously won 3 of the last 4 league titles. Hiroshima are managed by Hiroshi Jofuku, who is beginning his 4th season in charge at the Edeon Stadium. Previous finishes of 2nd, 6th, and 8th, so they've slipped down the table in the last 3 seasons, gents. But well, Johnny, I'll come to you first on Sanfrecce. We had a question from Gabriel Anello on them. Gab says that they've been punching above their weight in 2018 and 2019, though 2020 was decent. Can they do it again and confirm themselves in the top half of the table?
Again, quick answer: yes, they can, but where exactly they're going to finish is quite difficult for me. I know because Scott McIntyre, I think, had them up in fourth last week, which was interesting because I thought if they get the best 11 players playing over 90% of the games, fourth is not a ridiculous prediction for them, or having them in the top six is not ridiculous either. Just the central spine of the team, like the attacking midfielder, central midfield, centre-back, I think it's kind of falling off a cliff if someone like Morishima or Kawabe or Araki get injured. I don't see any kind of depth in there. And with so the new signing, obviously, Junior Santos has come in to replace Leandro Pereira. There's some part of the Junior Santos story we don't know about. Like, why has he not stayed at Kashiwa? Why is he not still at Marinos? I can't believe he's gone to San Freche for the money. So if there's some sort of issue with him that's going to kind of rear its ugly head this season, we'll see. I could see them coming anywhere from between about 4th and 12th, depending on injuries and form and things sticking together.
Now, Sam, they've also been fairly limited in their transfer dealings, but where you could argue that, Gumba and Nagoya have been quality rather than quantity, I'm not sure there's a massive amount of quality in the, or at least, decent names in terms of the six or seven players they brought in, other than Junior Santos, who, as Johnny says, it seems to be a direct replacement for Leandro Pereira.
Yeah, they've done very little. I think finances are quite tight at Hiroshima. In the winter, their main aim was to get Leandro Pereira on a permanent deal, and he chose Gamba. So they've had to settle for Junior Santos again, which is another interesting one. Why are they settling for him when he should be, you'd think after his performances for Marinos, he should be first pick for a lot of teams, but again, he wasn't. He should just... You'd expect if he's just played the way he did last year, he'd kind of get to a similar level to Pereira, so I think it's fairly a like-for-like switch. But then otherwise, they've not done a great deal. They've brought in Yuta Imatsu from Kofu, who I don't think he's going to be near the first team. He might play a few Levan Cup matches. They've got Yuichi Naganuma back from Ehime. I mean, Ken might be a backup on the right-hand side, but really, that's... about it. I can't really see any other new signings. So, yeah, they've not really changed anything in terms of personnel. The interesting thing that's come out of pre-season is, like, Hiroshima Forever have been a 3-6-1/3-5-2 formation, and you could just, that would be it every time. But they've gone to a 4 at the back in pre-season. I don't know whether it's just an experiment, just to see if it works, but they're playing Chajima and Higashi, who really aren't fullbacks. They're playing them as left and right back. So it's going to be very interesting, because Hiroshima, they're not very interesting all the time necessarily, but they're always quite reliable and quite solid, and that first 11 is a very good team on paper, and if that sticks together. And in the system previously, you can see them finishing in the ACL places, as they have done in previous seasons. But, yeah, this change of formation is interesting. I don't know if they're going to be suited to it, and I think it could rock them a little bit. I mean, yeah, when you're playing two players out of position at full-back, and the team really has been so settled on one way of playing, I think it's a bit of a gamble. And, I'm not convinced it's going to pay off.
Interesting. And, it's not like Jofuku to change things up so drastically, I wouldn't have thought. But, I don't know, maybe his hand was forced. We'll wait and see how it pans out. Thanks for your question, Gab. We also had, another... question from Ryan Cook. As I said earlier, he's dove straight in, and we really appreciate your questions, Ryan. So basically on Hiroshima, I guess swapping Leandro Pereira for Junior Santos. Ryan asks, what do Hiroshima do now that their top scorer has gone to the team that finished second last season? Well, I guess, Ryan, they get what they think is the next best cab off the rank in the shape of Junior Santos. Ryan's curious why would they let Leandro slip through their fingers, Johnny? Since he was on loan for Matsumoto for so long. Obviously, they had numerous opportunities to make that deal permanent, and you can't argue with his record with Hiroshima, Johnny. So I guess, yeah, what Sam said earlier about the financial situation of the club, that just appears to have hamstrung them in terms of making Leandro's move permanent. But I guess they still were able to stump up the cash for Junior Santos. So in some respects, it is quite a head-scratching transaction, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the loan dealings within Japan are always a bit of a kind of head scratcher. Why would one of the third top scorer in J1 be on loan from a J2 side is something I can't really get my head round. I think the answer to why they couldn't keep hold of him was quite simple. I think he had interest in the Middle East and China and also Gamban. They were all offering more than he would have got if he'd stayed at Hiroshima. One thing, obviously this is talking as a kind of Gamba fan, but whenever I watch Pereira, he scored twice in three games against Gamba, I think, but he seemed to miss a lot of chances whenever I watched both him and Douglas Vieira, because I think like Morishima behind, I noticed in the new soccer Mekan, he had 7 assists in 2019, and he was down to just 1 last year, and I remember him setting up quite a few good chances for both the Brazilian forwards, and they missed a few of them. So like Pereira scored 15, but it felt like he left some out there. Like he could have actually got more if he'd been a bit more clinical. So maybe Junior Santos is potentially an upgrade. I know some Gamba fans on Twitter were saying they would have actually preferred the younger and cheaper Junior Santos to the older and more expensive Pereira, but I guess time will tell how that works out.
Yeah, all right then. So we'll wait and see on Hiroshima. Sam, I guess we've gotten accustomed to Jofuku Ball. It's not quite as attractive as Ange Ball, obviously, but what can you tell us about the style of play for Hiroshima? They've tended to be I don't want to taint your answer with my expression. So yeah, the style of play, Andrew Schmidt's original question about what will you get if you tune into a Hiroshima game?
Yeah, I don't want to be too negative. I mean, functional is how I'd describe it. Everyone has their role, and it's kind of quite rigid. It's slightly similar to the way that Lottina would set his teams up, and the way it's quite, everyone has their position. You don't really stray from it too much. There's not too much room for individual flair. But there are good players in that team. Morishima, as Johnny said, his stats there don't sound too exciting, but I mean, I didn't think he played badly last year. I think he does create a lot of chances. And you've got players like Hayao Kawabe, I think he's a terrific midfielder. I think Yuya Asano came in last year. He has a few goals about him. So maybe it's a bit similar to Nagoya as well, where there are players of quality in the rigid framework that the team sets up in. So, yeah, there are bits about Hiroshima that are quite exciting to watch, but generally, yeah, it's not a team I get up for at 6 a.m. and I'm particularly delighted about watching. They are, but this formation change really has me intrigued. I've not watched a game with them playing this way. As you said, I don't expect Hiroshi Jofuku to make a massive change to the way that they're playing, but it does intrigue me that they might be looking to get a little bit more out of their attacking players, give them a little bit more freedom going forward. So, yeah, I might give them a chance for the first couple of games, and hopefully they've improved slightly.
Yeah, all right then. So Hiroshima under Hiroshi Jofuku, now into their fourth season. They are at home against Sendai on Saturday in the opening round. So you would expect they will get off to a winning start. But as we know in J1, anything is possible. All right, so with that, that is all 20 clubs previewed then ahead of the big kickoff on Friday night with Kawasaki hosting Yokohama F. Marinos. But before we go, a bit of a wrap-up, I suppose, of the preseason and the way we're feeling. I'll come straight out and say it, guys. I'm not going to share my J-Pred with you because I haven't finalised it yet, quite frankly. My mind is still, apart from Kawasaki winning the league again, my mind is basically, I'm all over the place. So, I think as has been discussed in the past couple of weeks, I mean, there's 7 or 8 you've got to whittle down to 4 for relegation. And there's, I would argue 6 or 7 that could finish in the top 4 as well. Well, to round out the top 4 that I have after Kawasaki winning. So, I'm certainly not going to push the boat out, and I probably will try and set my alarm for like 3 o'clock in the morning so I can sneak my J-Pred in while while no one's watching, and hope that nobody notices, because it's all going to blow up in my face very quickly. I'm certain of that. Sam, you just had a couple of general questions for us to chat about before we wrap it all up, and surprises, etc.
Yeah, to wrap things up. Do you both have maybe a team that you think might surprise some, maybe a lower half team that might get into the top half, or maybe a team from mid-table going into the Champions League? And then conversely, any team that you think might really disappoint, might be a shock relegation candidate, something like that.
You want to go first, Johnny?
This is actually quite a tough question. For the team that might surprise, I've actually gone for Fukuoka. At the moment, I think I could easily see them being relegated, but like we've said, there's so many teams down there that, you could see one of these teams if things click, and they seem to have enough kind of big name players like Bruno Mendes or like Tatsuki Nara, and the midfield looks like it could be quite decent. So I could see them, if everything clicked, they could maybe finish like 11th or something, which I think would be very surprising. Equally, they could finish 20th, so I'm not too sure about that. I think what we mentioned earlier with Kobe, I have them about 7th. I think they might finish a bit higher than other teams, than other people might think. I don't actually have a shock relegation candidate, because I think, for my money, like if Sendai and Shonan had gone down last year, I wouldn't have expected them to come back up with only two teams coming up. So I think they'll both go down. I actually chose Yokohama F. Marinos as a team who could disappoint. It might seem a bit funny, because I think they'll improve from 9th to maybe about 5th or 4th, but I don't think they'll be anywhere near, I think they'll be miles off whoever finishes first. I think not being in the ACL will help them, but I think there's underlying issues maybe with the system, and a lot of the players played the very best season they could possibly play in 2019, and I don't see them getting back to that level again. So where they'll be decent, I think if you've got them first or second, I think you might be a bit disappointed. How about you, Ben?
There's so many interesting clubs to choose from, isn't there? Yeah, I think that Kobe will finish in the top half, but I don't think they will be threatening the ACL places. But I guess a rise of 14th up to, 10th, or maybe, between 8th to 10th does constitute a decent rise up the table. Some would argue that's to be expected without the ACL, but hopefully, I think it's just a professional pride amongst the playing group. We'll see them do better more consistently, and we'll see them finish in the top half. I haven't decided yet, but I think one of the promoted teams will stay up, and I'm leaning towards Tokushima, but I'm not 100% sure yet. I think they'll both do quite well, because as we know, there are some fairly ordinary teams down towards the foot of the table. In terms of a team really taking a huge rise up or down the table, I don't really think so, apart from, as I say, maybe Kobe rising up 4 or 5 spots, but I think these clubs are pretty much a much of a muchness from basically, 4th down. I guess Cerezo could slip to, upper bottom half of the table, if that makes sense. But I don't think they're going to plummet all the way down to a relegation dogfight. I think, what we saw in 2020, even though it was such a strange season, and such a congested schedule, I don't think there's going to be too many clubs breaking the mould, say, that they set last season. I think most of the bottom half clubs are likely to be there again, with the likely exception of Kobe. So what about yourself, Sam? Or just to throw your own question back at you.
Oh, I didn't prepare for this. No, I'd say, in terms of the two that might surprise, I agree. I think both newly promoted sides could do okay. I'm going to lean with Tokushima as well. I just think their style is a little bit different to what a lot of the teams are like at the bottom of the table. I think they might surprise a few people. I'd be more confident in this pick if Ricardo Rodriguez was still there. But I think, they're a little bit different. They play a lovely brand of football, and I think they could be a team similar to the way Oita played in their first season back. So, I could see them finishing high mid-table. I don't think top half or anything. And the other team would be Shimizu, because they've just completely revamped their side. They're not going to be particularly exciting to watch, but Lotina will get that team playing a really... They'll be a lot more solid. They've got a lot of quality players in there. So I think if they click, they could be an outside bet for maybe a 10th place finish, something like that. In terms of disappointments, I think I showed my hand earlier with Cerezo and Urawa, although Urawa... I don't think they'll get relegated. I think they'll be in a similar position to the way they are. But I think some people might think that Ricardo Rodriguez will go in and transform that team pretty quickly. But I think, yeah, the new players having to gel. I think there's so many things going wrong off the field. I think Urawa might have a really slow start. And if they panic at that point, and then, yeah, I think it could go awry for them. But the other one would be Cerezo. I think I agree with you. Maybe a drop into the top of the bottom half, I think, could be the way to go. I think they'll be... I don't see them as an ACL candidate, and they should be, really, given the squad that they've got and the play, and the way they played last season. But, yeah, I'd have them as the team maybe that drops the furthest.
All right. And you wanted to ask us about, yeah, players to watch throughout this season, and that's, again, I guess something that would interest Andrew Schmidt or other neutrals. Yeah, perhaps new players into the league or young players poised for a breakout. And I'd like to go first because I'm worried that somebody else is going to take my player, and it's Akira Disaro at Shimizu. You've just mentioned them, Sam. It's going to be fascinating to watch them under Lotina, but also, yeah, to as they try and become more defensively solid, but while they also try and bed in a player like Disaro, who the J-Talk Extra Time boys just raved about on a consistent basis last season, his performances for Kitakyushu. I fully appreciate he's not going to walk straight into the S-Pulse first team, but yeah, I'm really interested to see how he gets on. And you know, it's always interesting to see, players who do well in J2, how they handle the leap, and some take to it like a duck to water, and others really struggle. So, I'm not expecting 15, 20 goals, but I'm just really fascinated to watch him. Well, firstly, to watch his chrome dome swanning around Nihon Daira should be absolutely fantastic. But also how he actually gets on and takes to life in J1. He's definitely my player to watch, apart from Michel Madoy and Shuto Abe, of course. Who wants to go next? Johnny, you want to go next with a player or two you're looking out for?
Yeah, so I fully endorse the Disaro choice. I actually forgot to mention in the Gamba section, so I'll go through Gamba players first. I know we'd had sort of questions about, like, from people like, how much do we know about the league? So I wanted to go for some obvious choices and maybe some less obvious choices. So Gamba obvious choices would be Yuya Fukuda and Yuki Yamamoto, both had decent seasons last year and expected to kick on this year. Maybe a bit more left field would be Keisuke Kurokawa, who's a left back stroke left wing back. He played most of last year in J3 with the under-23s after we signed him from Kansai University. And he was in a really good run of form, and then he damaged his hamstring at the beginning of November, which coincided with Gamba's injury crisis in the top team, and he never really got in. But I think he could start to challenge Fujiharu there. For a very, very left-field choice, we've actually registered four high school Type 2 players this year. Issa Sakamoto is a young player who's been involved in Japanese various age-level teams. He played very well at the end of last season with the under-23s, and he's someone to look out for in the future. A couple of others from other teams, I think. I know Scott McIntyre mentioned Taiga Hata last week, so I'm not going to repeat that, but Satoshi Tanaka, Shonan, is a decent young player. Tatsuki Seko, central midfielder, right back at Yokohama FC. I think you guys mentioned before, he's probably not going to be at Yokohama FC in 2022 if he keeps up his form. Sam mentioned currently playing at left back, I think, for Hiroshima, Shunki Higashi, more of a wing back or attacking midfielder. And finally, as a kind of outstretched arm to Urawa fans, I think Takahiro Akimoto, who I think falls into the same category as Disaro that you mentioned, Ben. He's stepping up from J2. He looked like a really good player for Tochigi last season, and I think he could be a very good player in Rodriguez's system. So how about you, Sam? I know I've stolen a lot of players there. Is anyone you could add to that?
Yeah, I don't think there's any players left, is there? So, but yeah, I'll go along your lines of extending olive branches, because I think I've done the Kyushu teams a disservice, mainly for the previews this season. I've not been particularly positive about them. I think one player just from last season, he only played, we've mentioned him a lot, I think Naoki Nomura can get a full season under his belt this season. I thought he was fantastic, and I think you did as well, Ben, last season when he came in. And I think, yeah, give him a run of games. I think, yeah, you've got a really, very, really good player on their hands at Oita. At Sagan Tosu, Kaya Sento is the one I'm really looking forward to watching. He got his move to Yokohama a couple of years ago, and it didn't really work out for him. I think he was behind Nakagawa, so really couldn't get into that team. But he went back down to Kyoto for the second half of last season and got 6 goals and 2 assists from the right wing. And his general record in J2 is very good. And I think he will fit in very nicely at Tosu, kind of in the way that Koyamatsu did last season. So I think, yeah, he's a really interesting one. I think he should be able to get a few goals and assists for Tosu. And then it's going to be interesting when you see the foreign players that aren't allowed into the country at the start, and then they come in say, May or whenever it might be. And I think the one I'm most looking forward to is Diego Pituca at Takashima Antlers. He seems like an absolute quality player, pretty much a regular in the Santos midfield. That's a really high level. I think he will come in. I think he will displace Leo Silva, I think. And, I mean, he's a terrific player, Leo Silva, but I think Pituca will come in, add a lot of quality to that Kashima side. And if they're there or thereabouts in the race for the title, I think he will push them to another level. So I think, yeah, his quality is one to look out for later in the season.
Yeah, very good point. And we should also mention the influx of new African players into the top flight. Obviously, Sam's got his pronunciation game on point from the start of our J1 previews. So, yeah, hopefully you'll be able to keep that up throughout the season, Sam. But, yeah, obviously, Michael Olunga has laid the foundation. And, yeah, there's a few different clubs. Well, hope for that will bear fruit for them as well, as they've extended their scouting networks in 2021, Sam.
Yeah, and I've seen Kobe linked as well with another Kenyan. It seems to be all the rage, because I'm sure they're all as good as Olunga. That's what they're going for. But, Ayub Timbe Masika, coming from Beijing Renye. That's pronunciation is probably terrible. But, yeah, he's come through in Belgium. He played in the same team as Kevin De Bruyne and Christian Benteke at Genk. He also had a really random loan spell at Reading last season. So, yeah, he's been, I don't think it's confirmed at all, but it's definitely another Kenyan that they're adding. And it's really exciting to see teams kind of broaden their horizons a little bit. And not every signing is just some guy from Brazil. I mean, the African players have come in, they've got different qualities about them. Olunga has really paved the way. So it's good to see, and hopefully a few of those, are as good as they could be. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. Listen, Timbe, I mean, he's very highly rated in Kenya, but I've not really seen enough about his stats that suggest that he's going to be a fantastic player. But, I mean, yeah, it's really interesting. I just like kind of a little bit of the diversity. Sendai's is fantastic. They've got like a United Nations going there with the different nationalities.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's great to see, as you say, expanding the horizons of J1, and obviously, the J-League English social network team have made the most of it in the last 12 or 18 months or so, and hopefully they'll continue to do so in the future. All right, so, all that's left to do then is to fill you in, listeners, on what's coming up this weekend on the opening weekend of the J1 season. As you can tell, I really need to blow my nose, so we'll try and get this over and done with as quickly as we can. As you probably know, listeners, Kawasaki and Yokohama F. Marinos, our last two champions, they kick off the season on Friday night at Todoroki. That's going to be an absolute blockbuster, no questions asked. Then there are obviously 8 games on Saturday. That's usually almost the entire schedule, but we have 20 teams this year, so 10 games every match day. So 4 games at 2 p.m. Sapporo host Yokohama FC. Urawa entertain FC Tokyo. It's Hiroshima as hosting Sendai, as previously mentioned, and Oita host promoted Tokushima. Then at 3 o'clock, two further fixtures: Kashima host Shimizu, and Shonan welcome Tosu to the Lemon Gas Stadium. At 4 o'clock, Cerezo Osaka host Kashiwa. Then it's a Kansai derby involving Johnny's Gumba Osaka. Osaka. They are away at Kobe. And then in the only top flight game on Sunday, Fukuoka return to top flight action when they host last season's third placed finishers, Nagoya. All right, so that's it then. The stage is set for the opening weekend of the J1 season. Listeners, don't forget to get your J-Preds in. Yeah, of course, Richie Palmer had everything already set up. Scott McIntyre and myself had completely missed it. Yeah, everything's ready for you. Just use the hashtag JPred2021. And if you're not sure about all the predictions that Richie needs, just get to his Twitter account, at GifferRichie. And, we'll hit him up with a question if you need clarification. But otherwise, yeah, he has spelled it out in earlier tweets. Guys, good luck with your JPreds. Sam, is yours, we don't have to go through it now, but is yours pretty much nailed down?
Yeah, it's locked in because Scott kind of got me to reveal everything last week, so I thought I'm gonna have to stick with this or be made to look a fool later in the season. So yeah, mine's all locked in and ready to go.
Rightio, and same with yourself, Johnny, or are you still allowing yourself a little bit of wiggle room?
Well, I'm going to wait until you put this online, and then obviously a lot of my predictions will be revealed before I put it up. J1, I'm pretty set. J3, I have no idea, so I'm just going to pick names out of a hat or something, I think, for that. But yeah, J1, I'm pretty good to go.
All right, then. And also, listeners, don't forget that you can do the predictions, the weekly predictions game on the transfer market as well, set up by Tobias Dreiman and the clairvoyant Jeff Osborne. If you need any information about that, please hit them up on Twitter at Konzrai or at Okinawa Aussie. And with that, we will leave it there, guys. Johnny, can't thank you enough for your contribution this week. And wishing Gumba all the best for the new season. Thanks very much for your time, and look forward to catching up with you early doors in the season as we see how Gumba have gotten off.
Thanks very much, Ben. It's always a pleasure. Hopefully Gumba have as good a season as they did last year, and I can make some more appearances this year. Thank you.
Well, either way, mate, if it blows up in the Minamoto's face, we definitely want you on to chat about it. But yeah, for your sake, yeah, I hope it's a smooth sailing in 2020 and the team gets off to a good start. And Sam, well, we've done it, mate. 20 clubs. They said we couldn't, but we've managed to work our way through. And it's been an absolute pleasure. It feels like we need a holiday now, but yeah, the season's actually about to start.
No break for us. We go straight back into it. But yeah, I'm so happy to have done previews for it instead of what we were doing last year and just filling time through coronavirus. So this has been, really good. I'm thankful for everyone's engagement. I think a lot of people have got involved with this. Thank you to everyone who sent the questions in, the Patreons for their support. It's been, really great. And just another thing I'd just like to plug, not for me, but for Johnny. I think he's done some fantastic previews on all the J1 teams and all the J2 teams. So if you're still stuck for your J-Preds, I say definitely have a read of that. Yeah, terrific work from him. Really good read.
Thank you very much, Sam. Thank you.
Here, totally echo that. So Johnny, why don't you give us a plug so I don't mess anything up? Yeah, your Twitter account to follow, your blog where they can people can check out your work.
Yeah, so if I'm at bloggamba on Twitter, and then you can find the link to my WordPress account. Most of it, like throughout the season, I do match previews of each game. Obviously, in the off season, a bit more downtime, so I kind of went for some predicted lineups. It is a weaker sort of date, but I think it gives a kind of indication of where teams are at in terms of kind of relative quality. For example, like Sarasov signed a few strange players, but they still have a very good starting 11. That was kind of my goal, and the response has been phenomenal. So thank you both very much for your kind words.
Absolutely outstanding. Well done, Johnny. Great work indeed. And we'll leave it there then for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. So thanks again to Andrew, Ralph, Gabrielle, Jamie, Kevin and Ryan for your questions for this week's episode. Obviously, Sam and I would like to thank Johnny very much for his time this week. And we'd like to thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. Of course, as goes without saying, listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are as well. We'll be back next week to round up the first weekend of the J1 season. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast.